Om Parataya Pradibodhitam Bhagavatam Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kritam Puranamunina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamritavarshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambedtvamanisantadhami Bhagavad Gita Bhavadvaishini.
We're chapter 6, verse 7. Jitatmana prashantasya, jitatmana prashantasya, paramatma samahitaha, paramatma samahitaha, shitoshna sukadukeshu, shitoshna sukadukeshu, tathamanapamanayoho. Jitta atmanaha prashantasya param atma samahitaha. Shitoshna shita ushna sukha dukeshu tata mana apamana yoho. Okay. There's two ways to take this verse. Swamiji has taken it in one way, Shankara has taken it in another. Swamiji acknowledges that, but it's really nice to see the way that Swamiji did. I'll do the way Swamiji did it first, and then I'll do the way that Shankara does it, because both are wonderful, actually. So, jitatmanaha. For the one who's atma, here the atma is the karya karana sangata, the body-mind complex. So, the body, the sense organs, the mind, is jitta. Jitta means is under one's control. Under one's control means that the body and the mind are comfortable. The body... Oh. Yeah. Background buzz again. The body and the mind are comfortable, meaning not... They're under one's control. They're in one's hands. Yeah? Which means being in one's hands, they're not causing pain. Right? So the body and the mind are not a source of pain for you because they're under your control. So because of their jitatmanaha, then you are a comfortable person. You're comfortable with yourself. Okay? And because of that jitatmanaha, you are prashantaha. Shantaha means the mind and body are at peace. Prashantaha means very much so. You know, they enjoy a shanti, a peacefulness, a sense of well-being. So these are two genitives, jitatmanaha, prashantasya. So it says now, for such a one, we'll get to the second line in a minute, because under all of these circumstances, the person whose mind and body are in their own hands, and because of that, the one who is at peace, prashantasya, for that person, the atma means the mind is param samahitaha, is totally resolved. Samahitaha means it's totally resolved in the self, really. It's like in samadhi. The samadhi is just another form of samahitaha. So that means that mind is resolved. It is quiet. It is has absolute param, absolute composure. So for such a one, whose mind and body are in their own hands, and because of that, who is prashanta, for that person, their mind is param samahita, completely at peace. Because completely at peace. Shita ushna sukadukeshu. In these situations, when it's shita and ushna, these are opposites, hot and cold. Shita is cold, ushna is hot. Swamiji says in his commentary, in hot and cold, it's not like just a little bit of hot or a little bit of cold. It's when it's really cold, too cold to bear, still that samahitaha is there, that shanti is there. Hot, too hot to tolerate. So we mean the extremes. So in the extremes, the person who is able to handle the extremes that bring about dukkha, right? Or, so we take shitoshna, Shita doesn't always, another way of looking at this with Shita and Ushna, because the next group are Sukha and Dukkha. Shita and Ushna, Shita cold. Cold on the in this continuum doesn't always have to cause Dukkha. Like say it's cold on a day that you all want us to be swimming, have a picnic and be swimming, and it's freezing cold. Then that could cause dukkha because it's ruining your time, right? Or say it's really hot, you're going skiing and all the snow is melted. Then the ushna is ruining your time, right? And so, but not always. It could be you're having a picnic and it's warm, sunny, hot out. Exactly what you wanted. So now the ushna, the heat is causing pleasure. So here the extremes, in this instance, the extremes can have the capacity of causing dukkha. They need not cause dukkha. You see what I mean? Not everybody is going to get upset when it's cold. Not everybody's going to get upset when it's hot. But you can. You can. Mm-hmm. Right? It's the same. The same with any type of situation. Like, for instance, somebody brings in a beautiful cherry pie with a sugary crust. Wonderful. It's tart, beautiful. And you've just gotten the news that you're diabetic. That cherry pie that could be sukha for so many people becomes a source of sadness for you. And Swamiji has a whole story. He doesn't use cherry pie, but he uses the sweet. The whole story on how this that causes other people sukha can be a great source of dukkha for you. Okay, so here we're using the opposites like heat and cold, Shita and Ushna, where they need not cause dukkha, they need not cause sukha, but they may. Okay? So Shita, Ushna. But then the next, in the next dyad is Sukha and Dukkha. Here, these are opposites also. Pleasure itself and pain itself. So say there is a pain-producing situation. There's something that is causing you pain. The situation is a pain. Let's put it like this. Situation is a painful situation. Situation is a pleasurable situation. Would be painful for anybody. Would be pleasurable for anybody. That type of thing. Sukha and dukkha. The pleasure itself, the pain. Pleasurable situation, painful situation. Painful situation is a painful situation. It's not like heat is sometimes pleasurable, sometimes, you know, pain. Painful. So, sukha and dukkha. The one who has composure, that same type of samahita, that same type of prashanti, jitatmanaha, control of the body, the mind, the body and the mind, control of your sense organs, control of the mind, has shanti, even in sukha and dukkha. In shita and ushna, in the opposites, in sukha and dukkha, in things that are pain-producing and things that are pleasure-producing, that composure. And then, and similarly, he says, mana and upamana, in mana and upamana. Mana is praise and being thought very highly of. You know, when somebody says, oh, you're such a brilliant person. It's beautiful. You're such one of the most beautiful people I've ever met. You're a wonderful, wonderful person and you're so intelligent. Praise, you know. And the book that you wrote is excellent. That's mana. Okay, you mean praise and praise. There's nobody like you. You're a wonderful person. What a wonderful person you are. Swamiji has an interesting take on this. He says, you know, sometimes that kind of praise can be a little difficult to take, he says, because if you take it just as the praise, that's okay. But usually when somebody's praising like that, they want something. And so then your mind is going to start worrying about, okay, now, am I going to be able to handle what this person is getting at, driving at here? But anyway, that's mana is the praise. The upamana is difficult to take. In any case, it's a criticism or seeing you in a negative light, you know? And Swamiji uses an example. He's done a lot with this mana and upamana. An example, but in his text here, he uses an example like this. If somebody says, says how did Eddie go? Something like this. The person says, like if I were to say to you, we're having a conversation, I say, you know, I am really good at taking criticism. You know, I'm quite good at taking criticism. You know, and the person says, oh no, I don't think you're good at taking criticism.
And then you explode.
I've seen situations actually where you've actually been overly sensitive. And you haven't been very good at taking criticism. So I don't really think that that's true. I don't think you're very good at taking criticism at all. What do you mean? I am very good at taking criticism. How can you criticize me like that? You know? And then, but really, I mean, criticism is not an easy thing to take. So to have if somebody is really pointing their finger at you, and that finger is touching a sensitive place in your soul, you know, especially unconscious material, if it's touching a sensitive place in yourself, it will sting. And so to be, as Swamiji will say, like a screwless screw, you know, where that criticism can be directed at you, and you can actually hold it, metabolize it, be objective toward it, and not be stung by it. That's that jitatmanaha, that's the prashanta, that samahitaha. To have that type of composure is a great thing.
Like a
bigger
medicine.
But the mana of a mana, that's why they bring this. Shankara brings this throughout. Krishna brings this mana of a mana in many different instances in the Bhagavad Gita. Why? Because it isn't an easy thing. You know, it's much easier, in fact, to be praised, even if you're worried about if it's excessive, what the person may be wanting from you, you know. Especially with somebody in Swamiji's position, because they're lining up wanting something, so maybe that's why you would think of something like that. But the praise is one thing. It makes you feel wanted. You're getting positive mirroring. The person loves you, cares about you, thinks that you're good. You can relax in that type of situation. That's not pricking at you, you know. But the upamana is, because it goes right into your, it can, not necessarily, but it can go right into your self-worth and into your self-esteem. If there's any inner weakness in those areas, you know. If there's any, let's put it this way, if there's anyone in the unconscious there, ready to receive it, you will get hurt, you know. If there's a person inside, in the unconscious, who already is vulnerable, there's the vulnerable spots inside, then those vulnerable spots will get pricked. And so here, actually, the upamana is something really useful to understand, because if the upamana is there, the criticism or the seeing you in a bad light. You know, if that's coming at you, you can imagine yourself what it would be like to be able to receive that with the same shanti or with the same well-being, the same fullness, inner fullness not getting pricked, you know, as you can the upamana or the mana or the love or the care or being in a safe environment. And so actually it's a really good to hold this dyad, this particular dyad in your mind, mana upamana. Can I be the same in upamana as I am in mana, as I am in praise and adoration? Can I be the same? So now what comes is this idea. Well, now from this point on, when the upamana comes, or if I was really a mature person, and the upamana comes, then I should be able to remain the same, have the same shanti. That's what I should be able to do. So let me make myself do that. It becomes a should, right? And that should is a problem, right? It's not, because here it's not about should. It's about discovering the truth of myself, right? It's about discovering the truth of myself that and then the mind's abiding in that self that allows me to hold these things that are unpleasant. It's not that dukkha becomes sukha. It's not that apamana or criticism becomes pleasant, you know, that I should be able to remain the same as though dukkha becomes sukha, you know, and that everything just balances out to be exactly the same. That isn't the point. It's that I find in myself that refuge, that secure place, you know, that identity where the ahankara, the I notion, is no longer really identified with the mind, it's identified with the Atma. And the Atma doesn't, the self doesn't become inflated with praise, and it doesn't become deflated with criticism. And so say my mind has found that abode, and from that abode then is able to respond. See what I mean? The mind, the wounds of the mind, you know, are being worked, the wounds of the mind are being worked through by all of the different type of work we do, all of the inner child work and all of this type of work, which is important. All of that inner child work is something that we do in order to kind of heal these wounds of the mind. But then as my mind grows and matures, and these wounds become healed because of the work I do and because of my knowledge, the mind's identity is not with the mind, it's with the Atma. The self-identity is with the Atma, not with the mind. And the mind becomes healed, becoming healed in the light of the work I do, then can handle this mana apamana in a way that doesn't throw me off or doesn't go right into the weakness of my self-esteem, that type of thing. So that's a lot different than saying, I should now from this point on be able to take criticism. And this isn't a discipline. See what I mean? I should be able to take criticism, so let me brace myself to take the criticism. Or I should be able to take the praise without feeling uncomfortable, so let me brace myself to take the praise. That isn't what's being said at all. It's being able to understand the truth of the whole situation. You know? What is the nature of myself? What is the source of the ananda for myself? What is the source of well-being for myself? And let my mind abide there. And abiding there, it enjoys a shanti, and I have some control of my mind. So here it says, so he says, for the one whose karma karana sangata, the body, mind, sense organs are under one's control, and therefore whose one's mind is shanti, enjoys peace, even in composure, relaxation, comfort, even in hot and cold, extremes of hot and cold, the extreme opposites, in sukha and dukkha, and in mana, in praise, and in censure, in criticism, that person's mind is param samahita, completely resolved. Right? That person's mind enjoys samahita. It has complete resolution. There's nothing that can, if it can handle these things, right? Then nothing will bring it out. Okay? That's how Swamiji dealt with this verse in the light of, in the context of all these verses. And then he also talks about how Shankara deals with this verse. Shankara goes like this. Same thing, jitatmanaha. For the one whose mind, body is under in their own hands, and who because of that enjoys some prashanti, prashanta, has some relaxation and composure, right? Because the mind isn't making you miserable. Right? Your natural state is to be relaxed and have composure. It's the mind that can make you miserable. So if you have that mind under your control, then that prashanta is natural for you. So such, and who has that jitatmanaha, in all of these shita, ushna, sukha, dukkha, mana, apamana, and all of these different kinds of situations, for that person, the paramatma, right? The paramatma means the self, which is Brahman. Brahman, for that person, is the paramatma, right? the Paramatma, that Paramatma is Samahitaha, always composed. So what does that mean? That person, so here it's really nice. Who am I now? For me, now that I am a Jitatmanaha, my mind and body are under my control. And so therefore my mind has Shanti. Because of being a Jitatmanaha, in all of these situations, my mind has Shanti. Okay. Then who am I? Not just the Atma, I am the Paramatma. I am the Atma which is Brahman. Right? So that I, the Atma who am Brahman, am Samahitaha, always in a state of composure. Now Shankara will say, that's how Swamiji did it. That I who am now Param Brahma, the Paramatma, instead of saying Atma Param Samahitaha, I say Paramatma. Paramatma is Brahman. So Brahman is Samahitaha, always and always composed, always resolved. Means the mind is always resolved as Brahman. That, so what Shankara says, the Paramatma is always manifest. I, the Paramatma, am always the one, Aparoksha. I am always manifest as the Paramatma. Who is? For the one who is Jitatmanaha, whose mind body is always composed, whose mind enjoys that Shanti in all situations, for that person, the Paramatma is always manifest. Myself as Brahman is always manifest. Myself as Brahman is always Samahitaha. Means it is always silent. It is always whole. It is always complete. The mind is completely resolved in Brahman. And so, because the mind now is not causing any ripples, right? The mind's not causing any ripples or distractions. So the Paramatma that I am is what is filling the mind, you can say. It's completely aparoksha. Another way you can say it is, I am Param Brahman. I am Brahman. For me, I am Brahman. And so if I am Brahman, what is the nature of Brahman? Samahita means it is always manifest and it is always completely composed. Absolute composure. So there's two ways of taking that. So let's go to the next one. In either case, now we're talking about the Jivan Mukta, we're talking about the Jnani. Okay? So, Jnana Vijnana Trittatma. Jnana Vijnana Trittatma. Kutasto Vijitendriyaha. Kutasto Vijitendriyaha. Yukta Ityuchate Yogi. Yukta Ityuchate Yogi. Samaloshtashma Kanchanaha. Samaloshtashma Kanchanaha. Jnana, Vijnana, Tripta, Atma, Kutastaha, Vijita, Indriyaha, Yuktaha, Iti, Uchate, Yogi, Sama, Loshta, Ashma, Kanchanaha. He says, they're talking about the jnani. The word yogi, but Lord Krishna uses in the Bhagavad Gita, yogi is used in three ways. One is the karma yogi. Okay. That's very common, karma yogi. The second one is the sannyasi, the one who does dhyanam, the one who does meditation is the sannyasi. So then he's also used as a yogi. The other one for the yogi is the jnani, the one who's approached the jnanam. So in these three ways, he'll be referring using the word yoga. Here, yogi. Here he's using yogi in terms of the jnani. So we'll see as we read this. It says, jnana vijnana tripta atma. Means the one whose mind, Atma, the one whose mind is Tripta. Tripta means whole, complete, satisfied. By Jnana and Vijnana. The first Jnana, Vijnana, Tripta, Atma. First Jnana means the one who has, whose mind is full, is complete, by Jnana, because of Jnanam, means correct understanding of the Shastra, the Vedanta. You have the Shastra Jnanam. You have the knowledge You know, Shravana Manana Nididhyasana, the Manana, you have the understanding of the Shastra, the Shravana gives you understanding of the Shastra. And the Manana also gives you all of the logic, so that you really understand what the Shastra is saying. You're a Shastra Jnaha. That's the first one. But now he says Vijnana also. You have not only have Jnanam, you have Vijnanam. Vijnanam means Vishesha Jnanam. Vishesha Jnanam means you have direct, immediate Aparoksha Jnanam. So the one whose mind is tripta, is full, is complete, because they have Shastra Jnanam, they have understanding of the Shastra, and they have Vijnanam, they have owned it. It's not just Jnanam, which is in a sense, it's not that the Shastra gives indirect knowledge. In Panchadashi, Vidyaranya worked this argument very well. When the Shastra tells you, you are Brahman, right? And it gives you the Mahavakya, Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. And it gives you, you know, Satyam Jnanamanantam, the whole vision of the Shastra. In order for that vision to be understood, you must have a Paroksha Jnanam. It's not giving Paroksha Jnanam. It's not giving direct, indirect knowledge. Because it's telling you, you are Brahman. Then you either say, yes, I am Brahman, or you say, how is it that I'm Brahman? So the knowledge of the Shastra is meant only for Aparoksha Jnanam, the direct, immediate recognition that I am Brahman. But until that takes place, you have a Shraddha in what the Shastra is saying. You would say, the Shastra says, I am Brahman. This is what it says. I haven't recognized the truth of that yet. I do not have aparoksha jnanam of that. I understand the Shastra says that. So I have jnanam, Shastra jnanam. But I don't understand. I haven't seen it yet. I haven't really embodied it. I don't understand. I'm not that. I can't say that I am that. That's what we call paroksha jnanam. It's not that the Shastra is giving, in the Vedanta Shastra, giving paroksha jnanam, indirect knowledge. It's just that we will call it paroksha jnanam until it has fructified into aparoksha, direct, immediate knowledge. It's important because otherwise you can think like this, that the Shastra gives you indirect knowledge. It tells you, you know, you are Brahman, but only that's only indirect. Now you must go and realize it. So we look at the Shastra as giving paroksha, indirect knowledge, which then you take away with you, practice, meditate, or this or that, in order to realize it. Mm-hmm. But we say, no, the Shastra is not giving you paroksha jnanam. It's just that as you're listening to the Shastra, and you're taking it on Shraddha, means faith pending understanding, that until that is understood, we can call that paroksha jnanam. But the knowledge of the Shastra is aparoksha jnanam, is to give you direct, immediate knowledge of the recognition of yourself. So here it says, jnanam, jnanam, which is the Shastra jnanam, which is vijnanam, which you have actually seen, recognized, to owned. Ah, I am that. I am the whole. I am Brahman. I see it. I am that. It's not the Shastra tells me that, and so now I believe that. It's no. I have jnanam of that. I have knowledge. I recognize. I see it. And from that seeing, the mind is tripta. The mind is full. And so what Shankara has a nice little statement here. He says, for triptaha, sanjata alam pratyaha. Alam pratyaya is that, pratyaya is the buddhi, the thought modification of alam. Sanjata means it is born. This alam buddhi is born. The alam buddhi is where the mind says, it's enough. We use the alam buddhi is to say if somebody's feeding you a meal and they're giving you seconds in India, you know, they're giving you seconds and then they're giving you thirds and you say, no, I'm full, it's enough, it's fine, I really don't want any more. Say if that, no, I'm fine, everything is fine, I don't need anything, I'm fine. If that alam buddhi is your buddhi, I know, I'm absolutely fine, I'm fine, it's the way What this is, I'm fine the way it is, I'm fine. Alam buddhi. That alam, the one for whom that alam buddhi, alam means enough, it's enough, has sanjata been born. That's tripta. So the one whose jnana vijnana triptatma, the one whose mind is tripta, completely full, complete, has the alam buddhi. Because of the fullness of the atma, I have what I need, I am what I already am what I need. So through that jnana and vijnana, that person who is kutastaha. Kutastaha means stable. Because the atma is changeless, the mind is resting in the atma is not modifying. Right? And so that mind has nishta, right? It's well situated. It's recognized its own self. Right? But it's really interesting when you think, for the mind has nishta. This is coming in our aparokshanubhuti. As though wherever the mind goes, the self is. Right? That's jnana. Right? That's when he's talking in aparokshanubhuti, he's talking about yama and niyama, controlling the mind and all of this. And he says, well, controlling the mind is knowing that wherever the mind goes, the atma is. Right? And so here the kutastha, that changelessness, it's not that the mind is not thinking or traveling in the sense of you're using the mind, but the mind is never anything but the atma, right? And the atma is not changing. So no matter what my mind is thinking or doing, I am kutastha, the self of the mind, which the mind is never away from. The self of the mind is the truth of the mind, like the pot is the truth of the clay. That truth is stable. It's kutastha. It is always the same. Kutastha means that which is abiding in the midst of an illusion. That's one word for kutastha, but it also means that which stands as an anvil. An anvil is, you know, when they beat iron against that metal anvil, like to make horseshoes or something like that. The anvil never changes. Right? It's kutastha. It's stable. So that I am stable. And I am the self of the mind. The mind can't be away from me. So wherever the mind is, I, the stable one, am. The mind can't get away from the kutastha, from the stability of myself. What if I have nishta? Nishta means what? It means that my mind has totally recognized myself. Right? And there, wherever the mind is, I am. The mind can't get away from the stability of myself. That's the nishta. You know? No matter what it thinks, no matter what it feels, no matter what it is doing, I am its being. I am the truth of its being. And so I am, you know, in the gestalt, I am in the forefront. I, the atma, am in the foreground. Say, that's the nishta. I am in the foreground. I'm not in the background. For the ajnani, the atma is as though in the background, because the mind is in the foreground, and what the mind is doing is in the foreground. So the mind is totally involved in itself. It's totally involved in the world. It's totally involved in its feelings, and it's doing this and doing that. It's committed in the samsara. That's where its nishta is. Its nishta is in the names and forms. It's lost in the names and forms. But for the mind that's awake, the mind that has jnanam, it's never lost in the names and forms, because it's recognized the atma, and the atma is the names and forms. The atma is what is actually there. And so you can't miss the atma, you can't miss the self in the presence of all of the names and forms. You are the names and forms, just like the clay is the pot. They can say, I am the creation. The clay can say, I am the pot. There's no pot without me. And I don't have, and the pot can't hide me. You know, it's like in the ocean, the jnani wave, you know, can say, there is no possibility, you know, of getting away from the water. I am the water. You know? And the water can say, I am the wave. You know, there is no wave without me. There is no creation without me. There's no being without me. If I pull the self away from the creation, there is no creation. And if I pull the pot away, the clay away from the pot, there simply is no pot. It has no being. That's mitya. This is satya mitya. When you think of the satya, what we mean by satya mitya, it means that mitya has, is not there without the satyam. It is not there. You try to pull the pot, pull the clay away from the pot. Where is the pot? It is not. You pull the water away from the waves in the ocean. Where's the ocean? Where's the waves? It's not there. So this is what we mean by satyam mitya. Now, look at your mind. You pull the conscious being away from the thought. It's not there. Right? And yet, the thoughts come and go and come and go and come and go. The feelings come and go and come and go. Nothing happens to the satyam. Right? The conscious being, the me never comes and goes. But think of taking that me away from the mind. And there is no mind. What would be left? Think of it, you know. You've got a thought, now you're going to take the existence conscious being out of it. What's going to be left there? There's nothing left. Then you look at the nature of thought itself, any thought. The thought comes into being, it's experienced, and it goes out of being. Now we've got non-being on either side. The thought's not here right now. Now here it is. And now it's gone. You haven't gone with it. You weren't there with it before. Right? And so the only time that thought has any existence is when it's present. On either, when it's present, when it's filled with me. But before that and after that, it's not there. Right? I am there. It's not there. And so I am the one. I am the one that is the self of the thought. That's the satyam mitya. Now the thing is to see that in terms of all my experience, everything, every experience, every perception I have, every interaction I have, I am the self of that interaction. You can't pull the conscious being away from the interaction and have anything left. That's why, you know, this satyam mitya, to understand it, that's why the dream example is so good, or just using, playing with your imagination, you know, to have a vivid imagination where you're taking a walk in the meadow or whatever, and just play with it to recognize who is there before the imagination, who is there during the imagination, who is there after the imagination, who is the self of absolutely everything in the imagination, and play with it until you recognize the satyam, the very self of the imagination. Okay? When you're playing like that, what are the parameters of the game? Well, it's you, the conscious being, and the vritti in your mind. Right? You, the conscious being, the me, and whatever the thought modification is. Clear? That's when we're playing with the imagination. Now look. When I am looking at this world through my sense organs, what are the parameters of the game? I am here, and the vritti, which is generated by my sense perception, is here. Right? And if I'm having imagination or a dream, what is here? I am here. The vritti, whatever's going on in the vritti. The vritti means thought modification. If the thought modification is generated by sense perception, it is still a vritti. If the thought modification is generated by imagination, still a vritti. If it's generated by dream, still a vritti. And so my only experience of Maya is through the vritti. My only experience of this creation is through the vritti. In deep sleep, when the mind is resolved, there is no experience of creation. It's just one big I don't know. If my mind is in samadhi, I've resolved the mind just to sort of its total focus is on the self. There's no creation. So the creation is either being known to me through sense perception, which I know through the, which gives me a vritti, thought modification of it, or I'm daydreaming or imagining or having a dream, that type of thing. That's why I say, if you can understand satyam mitya in reference to imagination, in reference to thought, in reference to dream, right, then you can equally understand it in reference to creation. Because, in fact, there is no difference. You are no more or less pervasive to the vritti in the dream, in the imagination, or in the sense perception. It's exactly the same. Now, the problem comes, and why so much manana and understanding has to be done, is because I have a dehatma buddhi. I am so identified with my body, mind, sense organs, this karyakarana sangata. I'm so identified with it that I think that, well, there is a big difference for me between an imagination vritti and a perceptual vritti. Because if it's a perception, the vritti, the what I'm perceiving, I know is external to my body. Whereas if it's an imagination vritti, I know that everything in the imagination, even if I imagine a character, say I imagine myself in the imagination, that isn't external to my body. That's taking place in my mind, right? But a perception is not taking place in my mind. It's taking place in my mind, but it's a perception of something that is outside of my mind because it's outside of my body. You see what I mean? And so that's why we have to analyze the nature of these outside objects. There's a lot of things that have to be done here to make a person understand that there is no such real out, there is no such thing as really outside. For instance, now, in reference to my body, through my sense perception, right, I'm seeing this room. Through my five sense organs, I'm perceiving, right, this physical room, which is outside of my body. In fact, my body is in the room, right, but I'm perceiving this room as outside of my body, subject-object. But actually, that isn't quite true. I'm actually perceiving this room with my five sense organs. I'm perceiving the body with my five sense organs, the same five sense organs that are perceiving the room, right? And so this body, your physical body, is actually part of the perception. It's part of it's included in the vritti, right? Now, also, another thing, do everybody see that in this room that you're perceiving? You're perceiving the room. The body is also part of the room that you're perceiving. Like, that's how you know this body. You only know it through your five sense organs. And so your knowledge of the body itself is contained in the vritti. The body is known through the five sense organs. And so, therefore, if you think about just that one little thing, what that means is that what I've taken to be the subject, I am the subject, you are the object, that this subject is actually an object. And so once this subject, I recognize this subject as an object because it's also perceived as you're also perceived, this becomes an object also. And that's why Swamiji will say, you have to recognize that you are both the subject and the object. What does he mean by that? That this I've taken to be the subject and you're the object. Within samsara, there's two levels to take this. Within samsara, within this room, here's the subject, here's the object. Because I'm the perceiver, you're the perceived. Okay? But actually, the subject is also perceived. The subject and the object are both objects of awareness. They're both objects of consciousness. Right? They are both known. The subject and the object are both known. Both known by what? By me. They're both contained in the vritti. They're both objects of knowledge. And so I am the self of the subject. the one that illumines the subject, and I am the one that illumines the object. And so I am both the subject and the object. See what I'm saying? I'm not sure that you do, so I'm going to go around.
I don't.
Okay. Look at it this way. Just as a samsara, just as a person sitting in this room, you say, I am the subject, you are the object, because I know you. Right? So everybody says that I'm the subject, you're the object. I objectify you. But what you come to realize is that, in fact, I, the self, am both the subject and the object. I am both the knower and the known. Right?
Because, like, you can say, I am cold.
You like know,
you're perceiving cold in your body, so you're, at that point, you're both the subject and the object. You're the subject.
Not quite. Let me just do it a little differently, a little bit more, go a little bit more inward to, than that.
Alright.
Doing it in a vritti wise, we'll say, I say, I am aware of you through my, all of you through my five sense organs. That's what gives me a thought modification of this room, right? Because of my five sense organs, I perceive you, I feel you, I smell you, I hear you. That's what gives me the vision of this room. Okay? And so now I know you, right? And you can all say that about your everybody that you're perceiving. I'm the knower of you. But now, in reality, if we look at it, what is actually happening here is true. Through my five sense organs, I have a thought modification, a vritti, which contains you. Everybody see that? Because of my eyes, I'm getting a thought modification of you. What that means is, say if my mind was daydreaming, and even though my five sense organs are here functioning, I'm daydreaming, I'm not having a, I don't see you. I only see my daydream. So my knowledge, the knowledge that I have, is only of the thought modification. Whatever it's doing, if the thought modification, if the mind is using the sense organs, then I get a thought of whatever is in front of the sense organs. If the mind is daydreaming, even if the sense organs are here to use, they're not being used. Right? So I only see the daydream. Now, what we say, okay, this vritti that is generated by the sense organs of this room, is it pervaded by my awareness? Is it lit up by my awareness? Can I say that? Is the vritti known?
Mm-hmm.
I would say yes, the vritti is known. Okay. Now, actually, I am the subject of the vritti, right? Because the vritti is known. Can everybody say that? Now I'm just moving in, that's all. The sense organs have given me the vritti, and I illumine the vritti, right? Do I illumine part of the vritti or all of the vritti? No, I illumine all of the vritti. Whatever's in the vritti, I illumine equally, right? So the vritti enjoys my consciousness. I light the whole thing up. And so, in fact, I'm lighting all of you up because all of you are contained in the vritti, okay? But now we have to think, what else is contained in the vritti? Well, my body is also contained in the vritti, because this body also is known to me. So it also is lit up. It's not just you're lit up and my body is invisible. My body is as much a part of the vritti and is known as your body is. Right? And I can go even farther. Anything that is lit up belongs to the vritti. That's what allows it to be known. So I could say the thought is lit up, the sense organs are lit up, the body is lit up. In fact, everything that makes me a knower is lit up. My sense organs I'm aware of, the vritti itself I'm aware of, the body I'm aware of, right? So, and all of that is, I'm aware of it, why? How am I aware of it? I have to have a vritti. I can't be aware of it without the vritti. Right? So all of these things, anything in samsara that is known, it is known because there's a vritti there. When the vritti isn't focused on it, like even say this physical body, I'm not always aware of this physical body. What about when I'm reading a book or driving a car or talking with you? You don't always, the ahankara isn't always going body, 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 body. You don't always, your mind isn't always focused on that. It's not always focused on your sense organs. Sometimes it's dreaming, sometimes it's in minds in deep sleep, there's no vritti. But whatever is known in samsara is known because of vritti. Okay? But now, who is the knower? The vritti? Is the vritti the knower or the subject? Or the atma? I would say like this. The atma, the self, is the conscious me, is the me, that illumines the vritti, right, that is required for knowledge to take place. And so, without the vritti, without the sense organs, there's no subject-object relationship here in the world. You need your the sense organs for a subject-object relationship. Okay? But the subject is known and the object is known. The mind is known, the sense organs are known, the body is known, the objects of awareness are known. Who is ultimately the source of that knownness? Is the Atma. And so what I take to be the subject and you are the object, I have to say no. I am both the subject and the object. I am this subject, the Atma that illumines the subject, is the Atma that illumines the object. So the Atma that illumines the knower is the Atma that illumines the knowing, is the Atma that illumines the known. Right? And so I have to see I am both the subject and the object. Means that there, if you say I am both the subject and the object, then I am neither the subject and the object. Do you see that? If I say I am the subject and you are the object, then I am here as a jiva in the world and you are the object that I'm experiencing. What happens if I say I am the subject and the object? Then it becomes like the dream. Then it becomes like the dream. Say in the dream you're identified with the character in the dream. And that character you're identified, you say, this is me. And everything else becomes the object. You know, so then I'm the subject, this is the object. But now if a jnani will say, I am both the subject and the object, means I am the self that is the truth of the subject and the object. That's what it means. It allows you, that particular way of saying it, allows you to see that there's nothing here but yourself. That the one that is me illumining this vritti is the one who is illumining the object also. I'm seeing the quizzical.
Because do you mind if I ask you this?
No.
Subject, do you mean Atma?
Yeah. No.
That's what's confusing.
Okay, let me go run it by one. When you say in samsara as an individual, I am the subject, you are the object, right? Then you have to say, that's a samsari. I'm subject, you are the object. The jnani says, I am both the subject and the object, right? So the truth of the subject is the truth of the object.
And by subject and that, you mean the body, mind, sense organs.
That's right.
You don't mean the Atma.
I don't mean the Atma. Okay. Because in samsara, here we are, and each one of us is a subject. And each one of us is an object to every, you know, to everybody. That's right. So I am this object to you, but you are an object to me. But from my vantage point, all of you are objects and the subject. Mm-hmm. Right? But in reality, I, the Atma, am both the subject and the object. Mm-hmm. And so I don't say I am the subject and you are the object. I say I am the subject and the object. Because I am the truth of the subject and the object. So what does that mean that the subject, the body, mind, sense organs that you've identified as the self, you have to recognize it is much a part of the vritti, as much known, as much objectified as the rest of the world. Right? It's not partially objectified. In fact, what is the most, the most objectified is your own upadhi. You don't have anything as objectified as your own upadhi, as your own mind, as the thoughts in your mind, the emotions in your mind. You can't have anything. I mean, everybody else's is coming and going. You're stuck with yours coming and going. All, you know, the most intimate objectification. But because the objectification is so intimate, the mind can say, I am that. Because the mind, your mind, is never away from consciousness. Where, see, I can, that's where the problem, like I can say, I am always me, the mind talking. I am a conscious being. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I am me, the mind talking. I, the mind, am me. But I can look at you and see you thinking and feeling and having emotions and all of these things, and I don't think you are me, because you can walk away. I'm not experiencing it as intimately. Even though both are objectified completely. Mm-hmm. And for both, the moods and the emotions come and go. I can watch your moods and emotions come and go, my moods and emotions come and go, my perceptions come and go, the sensory, the kinesthetic feelings of the physical body come and go, the sickness, the health, the aging, all just an amalgam of continual change taking place, which I'm very aware of. And how am I aware of it? Through the vritti. When I'm not having a vritti about it, I'm not aware of it. You know, I don't think about everything going on in my life all of the time. I'm having a vritti of it, and then I'm thinking of it. Or about my body. I'm not thinking about my body all of the time or this particular ache or pain. I'm thinking about it when I'm thinking about it. Vritti. Mm-hmm. Right? So that is our window into samsara. It's part of samsara, and our window into samsara is vritti, 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 vritti. When whatever the vritti is, that is what is known. You know? But those vrittis that include the recognition of your body, your mind, your sense organs, your perceptions, your memories, everything are vrittis. These vrittis are flash in the pan. I mean, they come and they go, they come and they go, they come and they go. But they come and they go, come and they go, come and they go, come like the froth in the ocean, you know, the waves. Come and go, come and go, come and go, come and go, come and go. But what is actually there isn't coming and going. What is actually there is you, your being. It's not coming and going at all. It is the very stuff of the entire creation. It is the stuff of all experience. Your vritti, you can never experience anything outside of your vritti. Right? And you are the very self of the vritti. And when you analyze the nature of the world, you find it is only mitya, because there is no substance to any object in the world that you're perceiving, because everything is infinitely divisible. Everything comes in time and goes in time. You can't find one thing here to establish that there's an... You can establish that there's an objective reality, but that not that that reality is satyam. You can never establish that this creation, which is Ishvara, and has an objective reality, an infinite order, in which this body, mind, sense organs is a part of it, but you can't establish that it is satyam. You can only establish that it's mitya, that it has no substance of its own, that its substance is my being. And so that's how the world, that's through that manana, through that understanding, you know, I recognize the mityatva of the world, not just the mityatva of my personal vritti. Remember I started with, like, my personal vritti means I have an imagination of a meadow and walking through the meadow. I can say that imagination is mitya. I can say the dream is mitya, because it's very clear to me that the dream has come from me, is sustained by me, resolves into me, that there I am both the subject and the object. I am the trees and I am the birds. I am the sky, I am the whole thing. Yeah. All of that is absolutely clear. The mityatva, that I am the Ishwar of the dream, all of that, there's no problem. I have a wonderful imagination. I have a great imagination and imagine a whole story, and I'm in the story, and you're in the story, and so many people, so much activity is going on in the story. Mitya. I'm the subject, I'm the object, I'm the sun, and I'm the trees, and I'm the stars, and I'm the whole. Jnananishta. I am Brahman, I am Ishwara, I'm the whole. I can see it so clearly. But now, because of the Dehatma Buddhi, I take myself to be this body in this creation, which is different than me. So that takes more manana, that takes more unfoldment, more understanding, to realize that actually there's no difference. That the waking state, the dream state, the deep sleep state, all are mitya. That this waker, this body, mind, sense organs, this kariya, karana, sangata, is as mitya as the little dream character I'm identified with. But I have to be able to understand the mityatva. I have to dissect this creation to show that it has no being other than consciousness, that consciousness is its being. As much as consciousness is my being, the being of my mind, the being of my sense organs, the being of this body. There is no difference in the recognition of the pervasiveness, the truth, the satya mitya of myself and an imagination, and the aparoksha jnanam, the satya, the direct, immediate recognition of myself as the satyam of this perception of the room. There's no difference because both are vrittis. Where the vritti is generated through sense perception or generated through imagination, both are vrittis. And so it's just the strength of your conclusion that causes you to not recognize the satya mitya in reference to the room as myself being the truth of the room versus myself being the truth of the vritti. It's because of the strength of that ajnanavritti, the dehatma buddhi, that causes you to negate or to see a difference in the experience between yourself and the imagination and yourself and the perception of the room. You see that? Because there's no difference. There's no difference at all experientially. Vritti is vritti. Mm-hmm. See? Yeah.
I remember hearing something before about how what seems to be in some ways helpful when you say dream or imagination in what Swamiji is taught, where he goes in at some point, or how you analyze even within a dream, you're basically still dreaming things that you've experienced or that you know. Like you know, if you say apple, you're thinking apple, then whatever you have experienced as apple is there in your consciousness. So
well, that's
the separation between what we generally perceive of, you know, happening in the moment, I'm eating an apple, and the dream of the apple really isn't that separate. And that helps you in perceiving how that ultimately the consciousness illumines both.
Okay. Yeah. Let's take it. Let's save it for satsang. Om Purnamidam 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 Purnamidam.
Purnam Gacchate, Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om.
Very good cluster. You know, sometimes you seem a little confusing like that. You have the vritti, okay? So, self-belief is the vritti. It belongs everything in the vritti. But then it can seem like that the vritti is caused by the mind, and then the mind is caused by the body or something like that. So somehow...
But that's kind of jumping argument. So if you do that jump, then you have to go into... Say if you say the body is, the mind is a byproduct of the body, or it's just the brain. Okay. Then we have to go into the nature of matter itself. Is there such a thing as matter? Yeah. And then when you dissect matter, there's no such thing as matter. There's only consciousness. Because then we're going into the nature of the substance itself. But say, if we're working on the mind, and we're working on when we're working on the mind, consciousness plus the vritti, we're working on what we're actually experiencing. So what are the components of the experience? There's the nama rupa, there's the name and form, right? And there's the sat chit. You know? It's in Drikdrisha Viveka in the text. Drikdrisha Viveka, they did something really nice with that Satchitananda plus Namarupa. Right? So there's the Satchit, there's me, another way you can say it, there's me and everything else. There's me and my experience. Right? So what is the me and what is the experience? That's what has to be, that's where we need the Viveka. You know? And then you look at, okay, with the experience, what am I actually experiencing? You're actually experiencing the aparoksha atma and the vritti. Because without the vritti, there is no experience. Right? So as a jiva, you're the you, the sat chit, that's part of your experience. The aparoksha part, that's the stable part, the kutasta. And then there's whatever thought modification is there. And that thought modification can be generated in many different ways. Through sense perception, through imagination, through memory, through dream. You know, we have so many, through intellection. There's many different ways of generating vrittis, experiences. But all of those experiences fall under the category of nama-rupa, name and form, right? They all are something which are dependent on the sat-chit for their being and for their knownness. The being and the knownness, which is me, is never objectifiable. It's always what is there as the very self of whatever the perception or the whatever the vritti happens to be. It is at the stable, the kutasta. That's the kutasta. You know? The me that is always there. And it's that me that has to be discerned. Right? And then we say, then there's all these different arguments that come, like, well, all that I experience is the vritti, I can see that. But what about the objects which are being perceived, right? Because through the sense organs, there's objects out there. Ishvara, right? So what is the reality? What is the reality of those objects? You know, in terms of me, in terms of consciousness, do they have any type of independent being apart from Satchit? And then that's where all this, these prakriyas, all of this analysis has to come in. And then what is the relationship of, here still, I understand this vritti argument and all of that, but what is the relationship of me to Ishwara, to the whole? All of that has to be reckoned with because the Dehatma Buddhi is solid. You know, that's the, which is, it's beginningless, that Dehatma Buddhi, it comes with the creation, that ahanka, that ajnanam, right? It's beginningless. Because there's no, until knowledge takes place, the mind, what's it supposed to think? It's always enjoying existence. As long as it is, it exists. As long as it is conscious. Why shouldn't it say, I am the conscious being? Because the rug's not, you know, the consciousness doesn't extend beyond the body in terms of my experience. And so I'm totally entrenched in this, taking the self to be in this form of the body. And then you all become different. So it requires a lot of teaching. I love the dream example because you can imagine the plight of a dream character in the dream. What that dream character has to realize. For that dream character, say you're a character in a dream, what you have to realize to know the truth, to be able to say, I am the whole, there is a long way to go. You know, from that dream character to actually be able to say, you know, I am the whole, this dream comes from me, sustained by me, goes back into me, I'm the truth of the whole thing.
He's never going to say that.
It requires a... But he can say that. But he, to gain jnana nishtha, you know, it's not a shaktipat. You go and bang the, tap the person's head and then they get some big realization and just, it's not like that.
But it can be helpful.
Yeah, it can be helpful. Like a guiding light. But the mind has got to, what I'm saying is that the mind has to understand it.
Yeah. Yeah. But what the dream character has to recognize is that there's just one thing.
Yeah.
Right? That's really what...
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's what the dream character has to recognize, that, yeah, yeah, that I am,
yeah,
the whole.
Right.
Yeah.
Where is the Dehatma Buddhi exactly?
Means that the Buddhi is the knowledge, the notion that the Atma, the self, is the body. So Deha, body, Atma, the self. Buddhi is that cognition, that understanding. We just say it's the notion that the self is the body is what we call Dehatma Buddhi.
What if you say the Atma is the mind? Is there a phrase, an equivalent phrase?
No, we don't say it like that, but I could say something like that. Buddhyatma Buddhi, Manasatma Buddhi,
yeah. Because
Chidatma Buddhi.
I mean, in my experience, I feel like I am the body or I am the mind. I mean, they're almost equally powerful. I was wondering why they picked the body.
Well, because usually when you think of the body, you think of the body-mind together. You think like Karyakarana Sangata.
Okay.
You're the body-mind complex. You're this whole person.
Yeah, it comes together.
It's like you're this person who has a body, who has a mind, who has sense organs, mm-hmm, who has moods, who has emotions. That's me.
Yeah.
You know, the whole, you're the whole complex.
And to know that is the buddhi, means Dehatma Buddhi.
The Dehatma Buddhi. Here, buddhi is being known, used just as knowledge or notion. Mm-hmm. The knowledge or the conviction. Conviction is good. The conviction that the self, the Atma, is the body. So here, when we say Dehatma Buddhi, we're just meaning the conviction or the understanding that the Atma is the body. It's not being used like Buddhi as the instrument.
But it's the erroneous conviction
Yeah, but it's it is erroneous, but it's a conviction.
Right.
It's an erroneous conviction.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it is a conviction. This ajnanam is very strong.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like, oh, maybe I'm the body, maybe I'm the not.
Those people
I'm
not
believing it. I won't believe that anymore.
But
Gary,
we cannot say it's
an
erroneous conviction because after jnanam also, the person has to still deal with the vyavahara. So then
erroneous, but then the error is known. In other words, it becomes a dagda bija. Like a burnt seed. As long as you have the body, as long as the prarabdha is there, there's going to be an identification of the body, but it's a dagda bija.
Mm-hmm.
It's different than, there's not the ahankara that I am that. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But just like a mirror is going to reflect the sun, if the mirror thinks it's the sun or not, well, no matter what it thinks I am the sun or it knows that it's a reflection, it's still going to do that because it's a mirror.
Okay, okay.
And so the body with a sukshma sharira, as long as it's there, will still, you know, enjoy consciousness, you know, enjoy a sense of self in distinction to you.
The sense of doership. And
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all of that.
Well, in that case, if you have knowledge, will the body still announce that I am me, and you know that it's not true, but it still has that inclination?
Not exactly. Of course, the body's not going to say anything, right? So it's
but the identity.
It can talk that way for practical purposes, but in reality, in its own reality, it's not going to have the sense of the self being the mind. In other words, the stability of myself is aparoksha, is always there, right? Even though the mind enjoys myself from its own standpoint, right? But it can't cover the stability of myself, that kutasta. It can't change that. Even all the while, it reflecting consciousness using being a conscious being, the conscious being that it is me. Right? And I'm not changing or moving, and that's aparoksha. That's very, very clear. But it's not as though all of a sudden the mind gets separated from the self and it's like some inert thing away from me. Because just like the clay, the pot's not away ever away from the clay. Whether the pot knows that it's clay or it takes the clay to be it dependent on its form, whatever it thinks, the clay is not going to be away from the pot. So like that, I am never away from the mind. I am the self of the mind. Right? The thing is the mind has never recognized that I never change, that I am the kutasta. It has never recognized that. It's taken for granted that I am changing as it changes. That viveka hasn't been there until knowledge takes place. Then,
isn't that kind of a jump, what you did just then?
Not to me. Tell me where the jump is.
Because it's like, I am not the body, I am not the mind, I am the kutasta atma. But then the mind has to actually know that also it itself, the being of it, is the self.
But wasn't that's what I was trying to say, like, I am, you need to be able to say both, where I can say that the mind can say, I am the self, but the self is not me. Right? Like that. It's like, I am, how do I say that? I am, the self can say, you know, I am the mind, but the mind is not me.
And what does the mind say?
I am the body. Well, I'm saying from the standpoint of the self.
Yeah.
But the mind is talking, right?
Yeah.
I am the body, but the body is not me. I am the self, I am the mind, but the mind is not me. That's what has to be.
Yeah.
And the mind, says that very strongly to itself.
It sees it.
It sees that.
It sees it.
Yeah.
Right?
the language is sort of interesting there, because the mind can't say anything from the standpoint of self.
No, but the mind can speak for the self.
But the mind can only speak from the standpoint of the mind.
No, it can speak from the standpoint of the self.
How is that possible?
Because it's talking about the self. Right? Like,
I can talk about you, your mind, but I'm not talking from the standpoint of your mind. I know of your mind, so I can talk about it, but I can't.
But there's no distance between your mind and yourself.
That's right, but the mind isn't a knower, and the mind isn't a speaker, or a hearer, or any of these
things.
Well,
it isn't.
So
the mind is a knower. It is a speaker. It is a hearer.
That's why I'm But you know, sometimes we say that, but then other times we say, no, the mind is. That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. But the self is not. You know, the essence of the mind is not. And so that, for me, that language feels like an obstacle, because the self has no standpoint. You know, it's like only that Maya has a standpoint. You know, that measurement from I to whatever. You know, from that sense of I.
Mm-hmm.
But the mind can talk about the recognition, its cognition of the self, but it can't talk from the standpoint of the essence of its being.
Well, the mind isn't actually having a cognition of the self. The self is the consciousness which allows for cognition. So the self itself is self-evident. It's not because of the mind that the self is shining or the self is known.
I understand that, but in order for the mind to comment on the self, that's a cognition. That comment is a cognition.
No, but why can't the mind, if the mind can comment on all of this,
right,
why can't it comment on that which illumines it, that it has recognized itself? The mind recognizes itself. I am illumined.
I think that it can comment on it, but I'm still saying it can only comment on it from its own standpoint.
From its own standpoint, but the truth of itself is the self.
Yes.
And it's not removed from you, so.
But the mind is the Maya Upadhi, you know, so.
Well, when you say, maybe I don't understand what you mean, from its own standpoint, do you mean that it is not really able to recognize the real nature of the self?
No, I'm not saying that.
Oh, okay.
I'm only saying that the mind can only speak as what it is. You know, the mind, the speaker speaks, you know, and whatever it speaks about, that doesn't mean that, you know, it can say the essence of my being is pure consciousness. You know, here I'm speaking on behalf of what I am. But that speech is still coming from the standpoint of the upadhi.
No, the speech is part of the upadhi. Mm-hmm. But what it's talking about is the self of the speech. Mm-hmm. You know, that maybe in the Keno Upanishad, says, you know, I am the ear of the ear and the mind of the mind and the eye of the eye,
mm-hmm,
in order to try to maybe get around this problem.
And isn't that why in teaching all the words have to be handled so carefully? Because the initial meaning of words is dual.
Right.
And so they have to be used to point to yourself, which can't really be described in a way.
The words can't describe the self, but because you are there, the words can point to the self and you can recognize what the words are.
I agree that the words can point, but I think my point is that they can only point. You know, that speech that the mind makes about the self is always and only a pointer. Because
it's always and only a pointer, but the thing is that what it's pointing to is aparoksha,
mm-hmm,
right? And so, therefore, it can point.
There's the shraddha.
Yeah. No, it's not shraddha.
Isn't it?
No, because the self is already there. It's already there to be recognized. It's self-evident. And so the mind is, the words are pointing to something that can be immediately directly recognized as the self, from the self's own standpoint, not from the mind standpoint.
And I totally agree with that. And I think I'm bringing this up because I think it could be an obstruction, an obstacle to be understanding
can be this sort of this way of thinking about the mind, the relationship of the mind and the self, and I don't know, I just think it's important to be consistent in talking about how to all this talking, all of this is the duality, all of this is the,
yeah,
know,
but
the Maya Upadi.
That's true.
And it's always going to be that, no matter if you're a samsari or a jivan mukta, it's always going to be that. That is the nature of, you know, duality is not going to cease to be duality, and now I speak from the standpoint of the absolute.
Oh, I see.
So the absolute's never going to say anything.
That's right.
So I think that's my...
Yeah, that's absolutely true. The absolute is never going to say anything. But because the absolute is aparoksha, it's self-evident that these words can actually point to the actual self-evident nature that you are, that is not dual.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, that's right. That's true.
Well,
but another thing to understand, too, is I was thinking, you know, for the clay pot to understand that I am clay is really not removed from the fact that it is clay. Mm-hmm. You know, so even when it says I am clay, it is actually recognizing what it actually is. Mm-hmm. You know. Because the mitya is, has no being other than that. No, that's right. I get what you're saying. All right.